Good day, and welcome to the Blooming Basics for ZVM and Linux on System Z Part 2 teleconference. This call is being recorded. To access today's materials, please check your calendar invitation or go to SSI. Business partners, please check Partner World. The presentation materials, transcript, and audio file of today's call will remain on the website for 6 months. Now I'd like to turn the call over to Julie Leisenfeld. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Tamika. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us live or on the replay for the second day of the Blooming Basics. Pam, Christina, and I will be your hosts today. We'll have three topics today, and each one will run about 55 minutes with a five-minute break in between. As Tamika said, we are recording these sessions, and we'll be posting the individual MP3s next week on three sites, on the ZVMT3 website, on Partner World, and on SSI. If you're looking for the handouts, they're on all three sites and on SSI. If you search down for the dates of 06-23-10, you'll see Part 1 A, B, and C, and so those will be your presentations for today. The first topic is Introduction to Linux on System Z. Hans will be taking questions at the end of the presentation, so please jot them down while you're listening to him. And Hans, I'll turn it over to you.
Hi, Julie. Thank you. My name is Hans Picht. I work for the IBM Lab in Böblingen, Germany, and we'll have this session here as an introduction about Linux on System Z. So if we just jump right into the presentation and move on to page number two, I would like to start with some facts about Linux and maybe set some perceptions right. So if we look at Linux, open source operating system, which was initially invented by the Finnish student Linus Torvalds in his spare time, the development of the operating system over the last nearly 20 years has drastically changed from an open source project which attracted a lot of computer geeks and people working on it as a spare time. And if we now look at the Linux operating system and the way it is developed, we see that approximately 75% of the code which is written for Linux lately is done by programmers employed by major corporations like IBM and others. And if we look at Linux as an operating system, people often refer to the Linux kernel, the core of the operating system, which bridges the gap between the hardware and the software. They think this is the operating system, but the operating system is more in the Linux world. We talk about distribution. That's the basic operating system with a huge software ecosystem around it to make it actually usable and productive with a lot of tools and a certain software stack on top of it. And Linux is distributed in DVDs. And if we take a look at those Linux distributions and the code on them, we can count that. And an average distribution nowadays has 283 million lines of code. And if we calculate that with traditional software development models, we can see that it would cost approximately $7 billion to develop something like that from scratch. Also, there's a recent IDC forecast about Linux revenue and deployment on various platforms, and it predicts an annual growth rate for the x86 environment, where still most of the Linux servers are currently deployed on, but there is a huge growth rate of 85.5% on non-x86 systems, and this includes some special hardware ranging from ARM processors used in mobile phones, but also high-end servers on the other hand, like our mainframe. So Linux is Linux, but the features, properties, and qualities depend on each platform. And if we talk about Linux on System Z, and let's move on to chart number three, there are always two ways to look at it. So what we see here is a picture of our System Z 10 business class glass model, which we use on certain exhibitions and shows. And we can look at it from two different sides. If we look at it from the front, or if we have a certain System Z and mainframe background, we will see the System Z hardware as we know it and the way it is used, and we'll see it as the mainframe we know, which can now also run the operating system. But if we look at it from the other side and have a non-mainframe background coming from the Unix world or the x86 Linux world, we look at it as just another high-end server which is using the Linux operating system in combination with some virtualization technology for server consolidation. And this is why we also call it this particular configuration, the IBM Enterprise Linux Server. And what you can't see on the picture in the middle is from the front you see the System Set 10 business class logo, but if you turn to the left side, it has a big IBM Enterprise Linux logo sitting on it. So let's move on to page number 4. What is actually Linux on System C? Basically, it's a combination of two worlds and two completely different worlds if we think about the background of the mainframe and the background of the Linux operating system. But nowadays, Linux on System C, or sometimes also called Z-Linux, is the synonym to run Linux on any IBM hardware, including the Z10, the Z9, and also the Z990, 8900, Z800, and so on. It is a native operating system. That means it exploits all the System C hardware like any other mainframe operating system, and this includes all the instructions in the processor and also some special purpose functions like, for example, floating point. From a Linux point of view, it's a pure Linux system, so it doesn't use the traditional app stick which we are known from the mainframe world, but Linux is an ASCII environment, so Linux also on System C is an ASCII-based operating system. It's not a replacement for any of the other operating systems, and you can either run it on top of the ZVM hypervisor or natively in a logical partition. But if we look at the current customer deployments we see out there in the field, the vast majority of our customers run Linux on top of or in combination with ZVM. Linux is somewhat different compared to other operating systems because there's not a unique version of it. There is the Linux core, the kernel, the operating system, which is developed and maintained by the open source community, backed by a lot of different IT companies, and it's distributed in a form which we call distribution, and there are two main Linux distributions out there, SUSE Novell and Red Hat, and both are strategic IBM partners. There are other open source distributions out there which are not officially supported by IBM. And if we take a look at page number 5, we will see what the hardware brings to Linux. As I said earlier, it's a combination of two different worlds, so we know the characteristics of the mainframe, the reliability, availability, scalability features, the security certifications, and so on. So a system designed for 24/7 operations and which has a mean time between failure in decades and redundant components all over the place. For Linux, there's a special engine. We call it the Integrated Facility for Linux, or IFL. In fact, it's the same processor which we can use for any other operating system from a hardware point of view. It just runs a tiny little layer of microcode that checks if you really run it only for Linux or ZVM. And this is lower price compared to the other mainframe operating system. On page number 6, we see a small list of the benefits we see when Linux is deployed on the System C platform, especially for server consolidation projects. We see cost-saving opportunities which our customers realize in various areas. It ranges from people cost, software license, energy savings, facility cost, networking, and so on. Software cost is a huge issue because if we look at consolidation projects backed by our IFL engines, we see that we can drastically reduce the overall number of processor cores. And if you deploy software which is licensed by the software core, this allows huge savings. But let's go straight to page number 7. So I have a Linux background. I've been working in the Linux environment for many, many years. And in a time where Linux was not yet mainstream, so somewhat people had the perception that if you know Linux and if you work in a Linux environment, you need to look like a real geek. So long hair, sneakers, worn jeans, and so on. And at that point in time, I had to disappoint some of the people who had that expectation while I was working as a Linux consultant. And now I joined IBM a few years back, and when I tell people now, I work in the mainframe environment, although only the Linux part of the mainframe world, they say, oh, you don't look like someone doing mainframe. So there are some certain perceptions of people and what they do depending on their background. But I think the biggest difference which I discovered when I came with my Linux background to the System C world is the terminology. Even if you or different departments talk to each other, they might want to express the same thing, but just the terminology is so different. So if you never work with a mainframe, you will have no clue what an IPL is, or stuff like that. You might have never heard of a BASD or the adapter. But the most confusing thing, in my opinion, is memory, which is called main storage on one side and main memory on the other side. And the second different big terminology thing is the person who is responsible to run and operate the system. On one side we have the system programmer on the mainframe side, and on the Linux side it's just a system administrator, or it's just admin. But enough about that. If we look at page number 8, we'll see an overview, a very high level architecture on Linux running on a System C server. So we already heard about the IFL, our special engine to deploy Linux on System C, and the benefits, especially for ISV software, which is licensed by the processor core. The foundation of our system is the share everything architecture, which we have in the mainframe, where all the resources like processors, memory, network adapters, and some very specialized devices like crypto adapters are shared among the different virtual machines, or can even be emulated if the hardware is not physically available. And the hardware is designed in a way that we can non-disruptively scale it and add hardware while the system is up and running. If we look at the deployment of Linux systems, we have the concept of logical partitions, where we install the ZVM hypervisor. And in this picture on page number 8, the white box you see is the logical partition. And on top of that, we deploy various different kinds of Linux system, and this allows us also to deploy production and test and development systems within the same system. There are certain virtual networking capabilities inside the box virtual network. One we see here in this particular picture is HyperSocket, which allows us communication across ELPA boundaries. And especially if you think about adoption of Linux for a consolidation project, there are some use cases that this is very, very beneficial. So if you think about a server infrastructure which is deployed in Splitty architecture, you might have a database on one hand and an application server on the front-end side. Those need to exchange a lot of data, but if these systems communicate with each other, the traditional data center, all the data packets need to go through a network card on the wire, past some routers and switches. So there is a certain limit in the throughput and also the latency which you achieve. And here our virtual network HyperSocket allows transfer in memory at similar speed, where we can do read and write operations in memory. So let's go on to page number 9. What we see on page number 9 is actually how Linux on the System C platform is developed. In the middle, we see the blue IBM penguin, which in this case represents the Linux and System C development team, which is mainly located in Böblingen in Germany, but also in some other areas around the world, in North America and India. From an IBM perspective, Linux on System C is developed by the same standards and quality metrics as any other proprietary IBM software or operating system. And the Linux system is composed of various components. On one side we have the kernel, and on top of that, for Linux, especially on the System C platform, we have something called the S390 tools, our essential toolchain, which is necessary in all the steps in the life cycle of our system, from booting the system up to a possible problem analysis in case the system fails. And on top of that, there are some essential open source components which are required, like the compiler, the runtime environment, and some special applications like Eclipse. So On the left-hand side, we see a screenshot of the IBM DeveloperWorks website. Because of the special license of the Linux operating system, the GPL, it's mandatory that all the changes to the Linux operating system are made publicly available in source code, and so this is why this is published on the IBM DeveloperWorks website. But this is not the most valuable information you can find there. On the DeveloperWorks website, there's a special part of it for Linux on System C, and this is also the area where all the good in-depth documentation can be found about all the various bits and pieces, each and every driver, and all the components of our SV90 tools package. On the right-hand side, we see a small picture of Linus Torvalds, the maintainer and creator of the Linux operating system, and beside him, the huge open-source community. So we maintain very close links with those guys for various different reasons. And one reason is that a lot of the functionality in the Linux operating system is shared among various different architectures. So if someone else contributes a new technology to Linux, it will most probably also become available for Linux on the System C platform. On the other hand, a lot of focus inside the Linux world is on x86 systems. So if Linux gets some new important features like changes to the scheduler, which might be designed for x86 system, we make sure that those are also beneficial for a slightly different hardware footprint if we think about a C10 enterprise class machine with up to 64 IFLs or 1.5 terabyte of main memory. From there, we have a very close collaboration with Red Hat and Novell, and IBM has no preference in terms of the distribution. We are neutral with both. So all the functionality for Linux on System C, which is developed by IBM, is subsequently integrated into the Red Hat and the Novell distribution, and from there can be delivered to our customers. We move on to page number 10. I just want to highlight some of the focus areas we have in the Linux and System C developments. On one side, we have integration, which is mostly about exchanging data and communicating with other mainframe operating systems, in particular ZOS, but also ZVSE. Then, caused by the fact that the majority of the systems out there run in a virtualized world and a virtualized environment on top of ZVM, we put a lot of development focus in that area. Then we have security, implementations about security, privacy, and also certifications. And then reliability, availability, and scalability features. On top of that, every once in a while, there's always a new System C hardware generation, and all the drivers for this hardware is then also developed for Linux. And we are working on customer requirements, so if you have a certain requirement which you think is missing in Linux on System C, you can approach us and then we can evaluate it and see if it makes also sense for other customers that we might subsequently develop it. On page number 11, we see a structure of Linux on System C. So if we look at the bottom, we have our hardware. The hardware is absolutely platform-specific and platform-dependent code because Linux on System C uses a slightly different set of hardware devices than, for example, Linux on a PC. Besides the core of the Linux operating system, the kernel, there are other important components like the compiler. Here we use the GCC compiler or the runtime environment which we need to actually run and execute applications. And the big portion of the Linux operating system is what we see in the middle and with all those green little boxes. That's the architecture-independent code. This is the functionality shared among Linux on various different architectures. And if we look at the percentage of the Linux code, which is platform-specific to System C, that's only 1.81%, so less than 2% is actually System C-specific. In other words, if you know Linux, you can also run and deploy Linux on the System C platform. And it's similar not only with the kernel, but also with other strategic components, like the glibc runtime environment, which you can see 0.5% approximately, or the compiler, which is one of the most platform-specific tools you normally have because it's creating code which runs natively on the hardware. And all this together leads to the situation that if a software is designed and written for Linux or a Unix operating system, it can, under normal circumstances, very easily and in a lot of cases without any additional code changes, just be recompiled and deployed on Linux on System C. So let's move on to page number 12. Here we see some of the advanced virtualization capabilities. We run Linux on top of ZVM, and so we exploit also a lot of the features we have in here, and a lot of them are in the area of CPU resources or, on the other hand, memory. If we run a virtualized environment, we have a little we have a limited set of memory, and on top of that we can do some memory overcommitment, but we want to use it as efficiently as possible, and we have some advanced memory concepts implemented in Linux. One of them is, for example, what we see on the right picture, NSF namespace segment. So this allows us to share the code of the Linux kernel among various virtual machines. The benefit here is if you deploy, let's say, 20 virtual machines running one particular version of Linux, can be /10 or /5, in each and every virtual machine, you boot the operating system. And the operating system, the Linux kernel, is mainly access read-only. So what we do here with this technology, we put the read-only part of the kernel into a shared memory and can use it then from all those 20 virtual machines in this particular example which we use, so this saves a lot of memory. Obviously on the left-hand side is a picture which should illustrate the CMM, collaborative memory management feature. So this allows us to adjust the overall size of the memory of our Linux guest. Our ZVM hypervisor has a certain amount of real memory which it provides to the Linux system as virtualized memories, but if you think about the deployment of 20 virtual machines, and let's say you initially configure them all with the same amount of memory, let's just assume 2 gigabytes. Some might actually need those 2 gigabytes, others might not need it, so here we can adjust the size of the memory. And if we move on to page number 13, we see a very interesting technology. We call it either XIP or execute in place. Remember, we can share the some of the memory for the Linux kernel, but now a similar technology is also available for application. So if you deploy a certain number of virtual machines, all running the same type of application, you can save quite a decent amount of memory here. So what we do with XIP, let's assume you run a certain application, it can be an Oracle database, can be something else, and you deploy it in 20 virtual machines. What normally happens, you start the operating system, Linux boots, and then you load your application into memory. But the application is also mainly accessed read-only. So the application, instead of loading the same application into the memory of all those 20 virtual machines, and some of the applications can be full-blown and using a lot of memory, we will use the read-only part of the application into the memory once and then make it subsequently available to all those other 19 virtual machines in this example, and this allows you to save some real storage. So if we move on to page number 14, this is a chart I borrowed from Mark Post from Novell. And this is actually for those of you who come from a mainframe and most probably Fedora's background and now look at Linux. There are certain differences in the way the system is managed and designed. And from a Linux point of view, a fair amount of the important configuration files are stored in the etc directory. And Linux configuration files are, for the biggest part, just plain ASCII-based text files. If you want to run an operating system, there are different ways to do it. The question sometimes is, do I have to know all those configuration files, what they look like, what the syntax is, what do I need to do if I make a change to actually activate it? And some of the things you can do via graphical user interface, and depending on the distribution you choose, can be either Red Hat or Novell. They both have some graphical user interfaces to make changes to the system. I think it is still beneficial, especially for complex environments, if you know what your system is actually doing and can make the changes also on the console by editing and modifying the files. And this gives you also a better understanding not only how the system works, but will bring you in a position to more easily do some troubleshooting or set up some complex infrastructures and environments beyond the actual limits of those graphical user interfaces. What we see on page number 15 is what, based on my experience, most Linux people do when they log into a Linux system on a slightly different hardware architecture. Those are two commands which we see here. The first command is displaying the information about the processors, and what we see here is the output of a Linux on System C system which runs on 8 virtual processors. And the second thing we see as the second command, uname blank dash a, this displays the actual version of the Linux operating system. So what we see here, this is a system, it's called TuxMaker. It's running Linux version 2.6.16, 60.042, and so on and so on. And from the version, we can guess here also the type of distribution which is used. What we see on chart number 16 is the way we look into a Linux system. And if you come from a distributed Linux background, this is one of the biggest changes. So in the Linux world, we are used to ASCII full screen consoles, whereas in the mainframe world, we have this line mode based terminal. And depending on how your Linux, you install your Linux system, what we see on the right hand side is the picture of the actual console, which we can get from the HMC web interface if we boot a native Linux running inside a logical partition, or what will be most probably the case is what we see on the left side. It's a 3270 console, in this particular case, the X3270 emulator, which is very popular if you run Linux on your desktop or workstation, but it's also available for the Windows platform, and this is how we log into our system. Biggest difference is if you make some changes to your system and you can no longer log into the system over the network, you need to know how to adjust and define certain files in line mode. And in Linux, there are some line mode editors. Ed is one example, SAD is another one. And it's good to know some of the basic commands if you want to make some changes to the system. But there's also the new technology is just recently made available, and this is what we see on page number 17. This is based on a customer requirement, in particular addressing two things. One is the security requirement from that customer who approached us, and the second thing is the fact that in quite a number of Linux and System C deployments, we nowadays see a certain split operation. So that means the infrastructure, the basic infrastructure, let's say up to ZVM level, is normally done by the mainframe group or mainframe department. But from there, to run actually the Linux operating system and make changes to it, this task is very often then shifted to the Linux or Unix group. And those might not be familiar with the concept of the 3270 console. So what we did here, we wrote something called IUCD Terminal Server. What this allows us is, if we run Linux in a ZVM environment, we can have a full-screen terminal within one ZVM system, and communication between those virtual machines is handled via the IUCD protocol. So in this picture, we have those orange boxes, and each of those is a Linux guest running inside ZVM, and those don't necessarily need to have an external network connection. So they can be just accessible from within the ZVM system. And what we see in this picture also is the blue box on the left side. So this can be our administrator running on his workstation, and from there he will open a terminal session to one particular guest, and dark green here on this picture, a special Linux virtual machine running here, which is accessible from the external network, connect to this one, most probably via the SSH protocol, and from there start our full-screen IOCB terminal, which can be used in two different ways, one via the so-called TTY, or on the other hand using the HVC device driver within the Linux kernel. This is a fairly new technology, so this is only available in the latest service pack updates and releases. I think less than service pack 2 or 3, RHEL 5, 4, and also all the subsequent versions. So if we take a look at page number 18, we see how a Linux system is booted. And in the background here, we use a virtual reader to boot the system, and our Linux system is installed on a certain disk, which is our IPL device, and it has a tiny little bootloader code on top, which is first loaded into memory. Then we load the Linux kernel image into the memory, and from there the bootloader passes the control to the Linux operating system. And this is the point in time when we see all those messages from the Linux system, which is initializing the hardware, detecting the amount of memory, discovering all the different devices like disks and network adapters and so on, and will then subsequently lead to our login prompt. In Linux on System C, we don't use the common Linux bootloaders like grub and lilo, so what we see on page number 19 is an example configuration file of the simple boot manager. It's also a plain text configuration file where we can specify certain entries. In this example, we see one configuration entry for Linux kernel version 2.6.25 and then some information. First, it points us to the file of the VM Linux file, which is the actual Linux kernel, and then to initial RAM disk, which is used to probe hardware in the later stage of the boot process, and then some parameters where to find the right files in which part of the file system and what are the parameters which should be passed on to Linux operating system, and in particular how we identify the disk from which we boot. You can specify multiple versions of Linux or the Linux kernel to boot. So what we see in the second half of this slide is the configuration example of a menu, so we can specify a boot menu and then have different entries in here. In this case, we have two, one for Linux version 2.6.25 and the second one for version 2.6.27. And we will be prompted, and if we don't enter anything within 10 seconds, it will automatically boot the second kernel. So this can come in handy if you have a Linux on System C system installed and want to do a kernel update, either for security reasons or because you make an update from one service pack to another one, so you can keep your old kernel in here and also make an entry for the new one, so you can always easily get back to the previous stage. If we move on to page number 20, we see how devices are accessed within a Linux system. And Linux accesses most of the devices by device files, and those are identified by something called a major and a minor number. The major number is what we see here in the red circle. It's basically used to identify a certain device, and for our Desti disks here, they have always the major number 94, so this shows us it's a Desti device, and then there's a minor number, which we can use to distinguish, for example, between disk as a whole and the various partitions. And also, there's a device file, and in this example, we see desta, which is describing the disk as a whole. And then two additional entries, desta1 and desta2, which are the corresponding partitions of the system. If we go on to page number 21, we see how we can query information about our current desta setup or activate a new disk. So the first example is what we see here is the lsdesti command. It prints us a list of all the currently active desti devices. In Linux, there are sometimes many ways to achieve the same task, so you can either use the lsdesti command or you can query a certain file in the proc file system, proc desti devices, which will provide you the similar information, but not in the same layout. So if we assume Your ZVM guest has an additional disk available for you. We see in the second half of this chart how to actually activate a disk. If we know that a disk is identified by a certain device ID, in this example, this is Echo Charlie 27, the first thing we do, we load our device driver, DESDIMOD and DESDECKD, and we specify a certain kernel option here, DESDI equals EC27, to identify the disk. And then the driver is loaded, but the biggest difference between Linux and systemc and other architectures is once the driver is loaded, that does not necessarily mean that we can already start to use this particular device, so we always have to turn it on. And therefore, we have the chccwdev command with the minus E option for enable, so we can turn the device on. And then we can either just continue to work with the disk, or if we want to check if the disk or the device was really turned on, what we can do is we can take a look at our kernel message buffer, and this is what the dmess command does, and from there we can limit the output to the last 10 lines, and finally select only those lines who contain the string DESDI. This is basically what this dmess tail grab DESDI command does. So now our disk is activated, and we can start to work with it. And what we see on page number 22 is the first step to make use of the disk. So there are multiple ways to access a disk, and we have the dest fmt command to do a low-level format of the disk. And if we want to use a disk for Linux and systemc for the first time, we need to format it with the so-called compatible disk layout, and we use a certain block size of 4 kilobytes for it. So here the dest fmt command basically formats a disk as a whole with the compatible disk layout in blocks of 4K each. And then we specify the device, in this example dest-db, and then we have the minus P option to show us the tiny little progress bar. So you only have to do this for the first time you start to use a disk for Linux. After that, you don't have to worry about the low-level format again. This starts to format your disk, so there is a check built in, so it really asks you, attention, all the data will be lost, so you have to type in yes before the actual format process starts. And then, depending on the size of your DESDI, it might take some time to get this finished. This is why the message says here, oh, this may take some time, please get yourself a copy. And if you specify the minus P option, you will always know the progress, because this is how we add the progress bar. And if we go on to page number 23, we see the partitioning. So we don't use the disk as a whole, we put it in different pieces. So we create a partition based on our DESDI disk. This is very common. The only difference is we don't use the normal Linux fdisk command. We have a special program here called fdesdi. And the second difference is that the system is limited to 3 partitions per disk. So what we see here basically is the fdesdi command. You point it to a certain disk, and then you see a menu with certain command actions. And one is minus A is N here. N will allow you to add a new partition. So each disk needs to be composed of at least one partition and can have up to 3 partitions at most. And if we created such a partition, and by the way, you can use either the fdesdi command on the console, but also the corresponding tools from Novell and Red Hat. But the result will be the same. We have a device file identifying a certain partition. This is what we see in the first line on page number 24. So we now have a new device file, dev-dsdb1 in this example. So the first partition on our disk, dev-dsdb, and then we can create a file system on top of it. And there are various file systems available for Linux and systemc, but most probably the most common one is the extended 3 file system, which can be created by the nk2fs command using the minus J switch, which is what we see in the first example here. So this will create a file system on this disk. Compared to dest-fmt, mke2fs.nos asks you if you are sure. So once you hit enter, it will immediately start to format the disk and everything will be gone. So far, the changes we made are not yet persistent, so they are only stored in memory while the Linux system is up and running. And if we want to make those changes persistent, we need to configure the Linux system in a way that it's also loading this particular driver and activating our disk at startup. And this is what we see in the second example on page number 24. There are some more features, especially when you talk about DST handling. So in case you run into a performance problem and want to debug it, it's what we see on page number 25. There is the possibility to turn on some additional statistics. You shouldn't do that if you don't experience any problem, but if you do, you can issue the command. We see here echo set on to a file called proc.dst statistics. This will activate the collection of some statistics in the background, and you can just display them by taking a look at the proc.dst statistics file. This is just a very brief introduction overview how a single DST can be used, but normally for most of the cases this is not flexible enough. Even though nowadays we can have fairly big DSTs with technologies like large volume support, but sometimes you want a bigger flexibility. So there is a technology available in Linux called Logical Volume Manager or LVM, and it allows you to combine various disks or partitions to one big virtual disk, and it allows you to increase or decrease the size and to expand it while it's up and running. You can combine with some RAID technologies like RAID 0, for example, and you can also make snapshots of the system. So if you think about using disks on Linux, you should evaluate this Logical Volume Manager technology because it gives you just such a great relief and flexibility compared to normal disks, because if you have a disk, a DST, you create one partition, it has a certain size, but if you need more space, you cannot just easily, straightforward, increase it. So if we take a look at page number 26, we see some examples on how we can structure and interconnect our systems. So there are multiple ways to do it. We have virtual network connections within a Linux, within a ZVM system installed in logical partition, which is what we see in the upper left part of the picture. We can have multiple Linux systems, in this case Linux 1 to Linux 4, and those can communicate between each other either via a virtual switch or a guest LAN, and from there the connection can go to a real OSA network adapter and then communicate to the LAN. We can have dedicated OSA adapters, but we can also share them also across logical partition boundaries, and we can configure hypersocket connections among LPARs to allow exchanges between the Linux systems. Another important thing is what we see on page number 27. If a Linux system boots, the first thing it does, it senses and analyzes all the available devices. So depending on your system, Linux might see, or your ZVM guest might have access to a lot of devices. But if you use only a small number of these devices, you should use the CIO ignore kernel parameter to make sure that those devices which you don't access from your Linux guest are not probed, sensed, and analyzed. And there are multiple reasons for that. First thing is the boot process takes much longer, but on the other side, it allows you to save some real memory, because if Linux has access to a large number of devices, it will sense them. It will create certain structures within the Linux kernel, because if it has access to 1,000 devices, they can potentially be activated and used subsequently. So the Linux system creates structures for all those devices just in case they might be used later on. So we can ignore a certain number of devices by specifying the device ID, but if you do that, you need to be careful, because some devices, and one particular example is the console, has a certain fixed device number, 0009, and if you put that in your CIO ignore list, you will unfortunately lose access to your console, so you need to be a bit careful. And we have an example on the bottom of the pages. Here we specify that all devices in the range of device Bravo 100 to Bravo 1 Foxtrot and A100 are ignored. You can specify ranges or a simple single comma separated list of device IDs And from within your Linux system, you can always query this information at any point in time, which is what we see on page number 28. By taking a look at the proxy or ignore file, you will get a list of all the ignored devices, and you can free up some of them, which is what we see in the second example, or you can also free up the complete list of ignored devices here, as we see it in the third command on page number 28, where we do an echo free all to proc CIO ignore. Then, if we move on to page number 29, as part of the S390 tools package, which is part of every Linux installation, regardless of your distribution, there is a tool called dbg-info. It's a small shell script, and it's used to collect various system-related files and information. There's also a tool from Reddit called SOS Reporter. Novell has a software package called Support Utils, where they provide a similar tool. What this basically does, dbg-info, it collects information about the devices, the runtime information of the system, and so on. And in case you have a problem with your system and you want either to open the PMR with IBM or, depending on your support contract, directly approach Novell or Red Hat, it is very valuable to analyze and debug the problem to provide this data. So dbginfo.sh runs just for maybe 1 minute and then creates a tar archive with all those files in it, which you can then attach to either PMR or the Baxilla entry, and this will allow us on the distributions to debug your problem much more easily. So if we move on to page number 30, we'll see another tool. It's called BMCP, and it's the interface which allows us to communicate from within the Linux case with our control program. So first thing we do, we load a device driver, which is what we see in the first example, where we do a modpro BMCP, and then we can use BMCP to issue commands to CP. And one example here is QVCPU, so it will give us a list of all CPUs we can query. We cannot only query things, we can also make changes to the system, and there's one example in the bottom of the page. Here we make a change to the defined storage, and we need to be careful depending on what you specify here, because you can execute also some disruptive commands. Changing the number of processors, for example, is not a problem. But if you make a change to your storage definition, your Linux system will be halted once you hit the enter key. So you need to be careful if you execute disruptive commands. So let's take a look at page number 31. There are certain traditional workloads, how Linux was used, or how our IFL engines out there in the field were kept busy in the past. And in the past, those systems were mainly installations where Linux was used around an existing ZOS or ZVSD environment, mainly for application serving, for applications like WebSphere Sub, Kicks Transactions Gateway, DB2, Connect, and so on, and then the classical strength of the platform databases, and to a much smaller degree, workplace applications like Domino, and also to a very small amount, only traditional Linux infrastructure services like Apache Samba, and so on. Now, if we look at new deployments where Linux and System C is used in consolidation projects, is what we see on page number 32. So here, there is a certain new set of applications. So web servers and web application servers, that has not changed too much, but a big difference is here also that development systems are nowadays deployed for Linux and System C, and I've met some customers which run their development departments or deploy their infrastructure on Linux and System C, even though the final software which is developed might be in the end deployed on another platform. Then I added some charts about a typical customer. So I'm not sure if there's really something like a typical customer, but this is what we see very often out there in the field, so I called it Acme Inc. Page number 33, so this is the customer who bought a System C10 in 2008, a model 2097E12 with 96 gigabytes of main memory and three IFLs and some storage on top of it. And what they do, they deploy their system with four logical partitions divided into different tasks like production, development, software, and one reserved for future use. And beside that, there is a certain stack of applications around it. So on page number 34, we see a list of their requirements. So they like a number of ZVM products like the Performance Toolkit, Omega Modern Operations Manager, Backup and Restore Manager, RUC-F, and so on. And their Linux systems are maintained by the Linux or Unix group, and what we see on the left side is a small part of the actual documentation. So what they do, they identify a new disk, then they make changes to the ZPM user directory and define a new case. They afterwards complete the RUCF changes and grant access to the virtual switch. And this customer is running Rapid, for example, the way they use Kickstart to deploy new systems, and then the system is automatically deployed. And on page number 35, you see an overview how their system is used. So we have four logical partitions. The spare LPAR is currently not used, and the production, development, and test LPAR. They run ZVM everywhere, and on top the Linux guest. And their systems are designed in a way that the three IFLs are shared, so they don't have any dedicated IFLs in this configuration. 70% of the IFL wide is dedicated, is used for production systems, 10% for development systems, 10% for test, and then there's another 10% left for the spare logical partitions. And in the upper right corner, you can see some of the software they deploy within the Linux system. So we have here WebSphere for production, development, TB2 databases, web server, and so on. We only have approximately 55 minutes left in the session, so I want to show you some websites where you can find more information. So what we see on page number 36 is a list of certain customer references from customers and business partners which lately deployed Linux on System C, or what we call our enterprise Linux server offerings, because there's also a certain amount of customers new to the platform only running Linux on System C without having a mainframe background. And here we see some white papers and customer success stories of them. And if we look at technical information, there is a link which you can see on page number 37. And this is part of the documentation I mentioned earlier, which is available on Linux on System C website. So here we have a real in-depth configuration on the various bits and pieces of functionality which are available for Linux on System C. If you want to configure a system for dump tools, or if you want to set up the IUCD terminal server I talked about earlier, if you don't want to have a traditional dusty environment but might have a look at SCP attached SCSI devices, or you want to look at the executed blaze technology to save memory, there are various different documents out there. And maybe the most comprehensive one is the one we see in the bottom. It's called Device Drivers, Features, and Commands. That also is also the biggest document we have. It's approximately 500 pages. It's describing each and every Linux device driver and all the components of the S390 tools package. So now we are ready for some questions. So if you have some questions, I'm available for that. Otherwise, you might also see my contact details on page number 38. And if you have a hard time to explain or express the value of running Linux on the System C platform, there might be a little video, which is what we see on page number 39. It's a video we did within the IBM Linux and System C Development Lab, and it tries to explain to you the values of running Linux on System C there in 2 minutes and 39 seconds. So with that, I will stop, and I'm now ready to take your question.
Certainly. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing star 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question, and we will pause for just a moment. And as a reminder, that is star 1 to ask a question today. And at this point, we do not have any questions. I'll turn the call over to Ms. Leisenfeld at this time.
Thanks, Tamika. Hans, thank you very much. And everybody definitely needs to watch the video that you posted at the end on YouTube. It's a great video. At this point, we'll go ahead and close down for 4 minutes, and we'll start up again at the top of the hour for our next session. I'll turn it back to you, Tamika.
Great, thank you. And at this time, we will take a momentary break.